folks on the street lights. We cultivate the culture, bring forth your contribution. City unite, rhymes, poetry, knowledge, wisdom, understanding, and being stupid. City unite, put in work, network, F work, do something, make it happen, make it work, yo. City unite, flyers, we pay, spray paint, make your mark, don't backtrack, grab your backpack.
The one from the Valley of the Sun, Master None. Walk your alley with.
This is the InfoShop podcast for April 24th, 2006. I'm Chuck Munson, the editor of InfoShop News, and I'm your host for this installment of our biweekly podcast. This program is a collaboration of the InfoShop News Collective and volunteers on several continents. This week we feature a recording from the International Anarchist Academics and Activist Conference held a week ago in Los Angeles at Pitzer College. This week we feature a recording from the International Anarchist Academics and Activists Conference held a week ago in Los Angeles at Pitzer College. We will share an excerpt of Alan Antliff's talk on 20th century Indian anarchist Ananda Kumaraswamy. I attended the conference in Los Angeles earlier this month, which brought together over 70 anarchists from around the United States, Canada, and a few other places. I gave a talk on InfoShops as part of a panel on anarchist publishing, which included Josh from AK Press. Other talks during the conference included Sharon Presley on Voltairine de Cleyre, Cindy Milstein on the New Anarchism, Ben Shepherd on Play in Protest and in Research, Anjali Nath on Anarchism in a Multicultural Perspective, and Saab Loftin on the question of, is the pen truly mightier than the sword? And those were just a few of the people who gave presentations during the conference. We go now to Erica in the Netherlands for the latest news from InfoShop News.
Hi, this is Erica reporting for InfoShopNews.org. What I'll be reading is an audio version of the InfoShop Newswire, located on the web at news.infoshop.org. That's without the www. New York fines transit union $2.5 million, jails leader. A state Supreme Court judge has ordered New York Transit Workers Union Local 100 to pay the state a $2.5 million fine, revoked the union's right to collect dues from workers' paychecks, and sentenced President Roger Toussaint to 10 days in jail and a $1,000 fine for refusing a court order to cancel the December mass transit strike. Subway and bus workers have also been docked several days' pay for joining the strike. Toussaint called off the transit strike on its third day without an agreement. In January, union members voted down the concessionary settlement the Metropolitan Transportation Authority offered when workers were back on the job. Students occupying Jeb Bush's office want justice in the boot camp beating death of Martin Anderson. Aaron Swartz saw it all, live and in person. He saw the screaming guards, the pressure points, the knee takedowns, the acrid ammonia stick shoved in the face of a rubber-legged 14-year-old named Martin Lee Anderson. They killed that boy. They didn't help him. They beat him, Aaron, also 14, told the Miami Herald. Like Martin's family, Aaron thinks there's a cover-up. Martin Anderson was the third black male to die in Florida state custody in the past 3 years. The Pentagon's New Spies by Robert Dreyfuss for Rolling Stone. Last October, before the public learned that President Bush had secretly ordered the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on Americans without a court order, the Pentagon approached the Senate Intelligence Committee with an unprecedented request. Military officials wanted the authority to spy on U.S. citizens on American soil without identifying themselves in order to collect intelligence about terrorist threats. The plan was so sweeping, according to congressional sources who reviewed it, that it would not have permitted operatives from the Defense Intelligence Agency to spy on dissidents by posing as peace activists and infiltrating anti-war meetings. Senators on both sides of the aisle refused to go along with the plan. The Department of Defense should not be in the business of spying on law-abiding Americans, period, said Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon. In closed-door deliberations, the Intelligence Committee blocked the request. In fact, however, the Pentagon has already assembled a nationwide domestic spying machine that goes far beyond the National Security Agency's warrantless surveillance of telephone and email traffic. Operating in secret, the Defense Department is systematically gathering and analyzing intelligence on American citizens at home, and a new Pentagon agency called Counterintelligence Field Activity is helping to coordinate the military's covert efforts with federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. Death in the Haymarket, Anarchy in the USA, by Alex Lichtenstein. Death in the Haymarket tells the story of labor reform, justice, and America's never-ending debate on immigration. It is impossible to read Death in the Haymarket, James Green's gripping new account of the Haymarket bombing of May 4, 1886, whose 120th anniversary will be commemorated next month, without a shock of recognition. Denounced by the press as foreign savages who come to America with their dynamite bombs, the anarchists ultimately held responsible for the tragic event touched the deepest anxieties of their age. The dynamite blast that killed 7 policemen and wounded 50 more represented, in the words of Chicago clergyman, the first explosion of a deep discontent on the part of millions of poor people around the globe. Reconquista. The Reconquista, a radical movement calling for Mexico to reconquer America's Southwest, has stepped out of the shadows at recent immigration reform protests nationwide as marchers held signs saying, "Uncle Sam stole our land," and waved Mexico's flag. "We need to change direction," says Jose Lugo, an instructor in ethnic studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder, at a campus march last week. "And by allowing these 50,000 immigrants to come in here, we can do that." The revolutionary tone has surprised even longtime immigration watchers such as Ira Mahlum, the Los Angeles-based spokesman for the Federation for American Immigration Reform. "I've always been skeptical myself about this Reconquista, but what I've seen over the last few weeks leads me to believe that there's more there than I thought," Mr. Mahlum said. Teen Screen, Stealing Our Children's Future, by Janine Warner. Our next generation of children is in grave danger. Teen Screen is working insidiously in schools to find children who can become the psychiatric / pharmaceutical industry's next cash cow. Bolstered by Bush's very stupidly named New Freedom Commission, Teen Screen is being pushed secretly into schools. "This may be good for the drug business, but is very bad for our children, and factually, for the future of this entire society." And that's all for now. Thanks for listening. All of these articles and much more can be found on www.infoshop.org.
The song I would like to dedicate to everybody who's a member of the working class.
Working class. Working class. Working class. Working class.
Class war, it goes on every day. People get paid in a crazy way. It's a class war, it goes on every day. People get paid in a crazy way. It's a class war, it goes on every day. Monetary, mental, physical decay. Monetary, mental, physical decay. Monetary, mental, physical decay. It's a class war.
This is about
community. Freedom now.
This is about
power. And who has power and who doesn't?
This is about
class war. yours. You gotta hustle from the bottom just to feed the poor. It's a class war. It's a class war. It's a rich man's game, no matter what we call it. And I'm spending our lives putting money in his wallet. It's a rich man's game, no matter what we call it. And I'm spending our lives putting money in his wallet. It's a rich man's game. It's a rich man's game. It's a class war. It's a class war. It's a class war. It goes on every day. People getting paid in a crazy way. It's a class war. Said it's a class war. It's a class war. It goes on every day. People getting paid in a crazy way. It's a class war. Said it's a class war. Physical decay, monetary, mental, physical decay, monetary, mental, physical decay. Feeling like you're used in a state of abuse. No need to be confused, cause I'm coming through. Feeling like you're used in a state of abuse. No need to be confused, cause I'm coming through. What?
That was Class War by the San Francisco-based duo Entartete Kunst. We turn now to this week's feature. Alan Antliff is a Canadian anarchist who recently published an anthology of Canadian anarchist thought, practice, and culture titled Only a Beginning. He is also the author of Anarchist Modernism, Art, Politics, and the First American Avant-Garde. Antliff is currently an editor with Alternative Press Review. Antliff gave a talk at the Anarchist Conference in Los Angeles on the 20th century Indian anarchist Ananda Kumaraswamy. We present an excerpt from Antliff's talk. The audio of the full talk will be available on the audio page at infoshop.org, and the address of that page is www.infoshop.org/audio.html.
Actually immigrated to the United States in 1917, and he did so with the understanding that he would never be allowed back into Britain, and only after a portion of his property was confiscated. In the United States, he became the curator of the Asian art collection at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, and published extensively on Indian arts and culture. What's lesser known, or at least was pretty much unknown before I started my research, was that he immersed himself in New York City's anarchist movement as well. He contributed to several journals and formed a circle at a bookstore called the Sunwise Turn. And the owners of the Sunwise Turn published his most famous book, The Dance of Shiva, in 1918. So who was Ananda Kumaraswamy? He was born in 1877 in Colombo, Sri Lanka. His father belonged to the island's Tamil nobility, and his mother was English. Following the death of his father in 1879, Kumaraswamy was taken to England, and that's where he was raised. And he earned a bachelor's degree in geology and botany from the University of London in 1900. So we're looking at someone here who's one. The next year they married and sailed for Sri Lanka, where Kumaraswamy had been appointed the director of the Meteorological Survey by the British government. So he goes to Sri Lanka, or returns to Sri Lanka, as a civil servant. Ethel Partridge, very interesting figure. She had a prior background in the English arts and crafts movement. Her father was an arts and crafts practitioner and a political radical. And she most likely introduced her husband, Ananda Kumaraswamy, to the writings of William Morris, and also another important arts and crafts theorist, C.R. Ashby. This is C.R. Ashby. This gentleman is fascinating. He was a real radical, founded his own arts and crafts guild in a region in England, the Cotswolds. After World War I, he went to Palestine and had an appointment in Jerusalem where he got the communities together and worked hard to preserve the architecture of Jerusalem under the British mandate and so on. So he's got his own rich history. Anyway, this is a photo of C.R. Ashby from 1906. The connection with C.R. Ashby and Kumaraswamy and Ethel Partridge can be traced to Ethel Partridge's brother, Fred Partridge, who worked at the Rural Arts and Crafts Guild run by Ashby. Sometime during their stay in India, Ananda Kumaraswamy and Ethel Partridge asked Ashby to refurbish a rundown chapel adjacent to his guild in the Cotswolds. And this is a photo of the interior of that chapel after Ashby had restored it. When the Kumaraswamys returned to England from Sri Lanka in 1907, after this stay from 1902 to 1907, they settled in this chapel adjacent to Ashby's guild. They stayed there for 2 years, and then Kumaraswamy began traveling again until World War I broke out. He was constantly moving back and forth between India and England. Kumaraswamy's political activism dates to 1905. This is the year when he helped found the Ceylon Social Reform Society, and Ceylon is another name for Sri Lanka, the Ceylon Social Reform Society, and a journal called the Ceylon National Review to, and I quote, encourage and initiate reform in social customs amongst the Sinhalese and to discourage the thoughtless imitation of unsuitable European habits and customs. One of the society's earliest guest lecturers was Annie Besant, the president of the International Theosophical Society. Besant was also a spokesperson for the Indian self-rule movement, which promoted Swadeshi indigenousness on two fronts. This self-rule movement encouraged the boycott of English industrial imports and also called for a return to artisan-based manufacture in India. Besant's support for Indian independence can be traced to the Theosophical movement's belief that the world was undergoing a universal awakening in which humanity's spiritual consciousness would overcome all social, cultural, and political-based divisiveness. An understudied aspect of the Theosophical movement is the connections with anarchism, which are rooted in this universalism. The Theosophical Society regarded consciousness as a prime force in history, and here they found a kindred attitude amongst many Indian anti-colonialists associated with Kumaraswamy. Notably, the poet Rabindranath Nath Tagore and his nephew, the painter Abanindranath Nath Tagore. Here are the Tagores. The Tagores were prominent spokespersons in the Indian wing of the Pan-Asian independence movement, which had followers throughout Southeast Asia, China, and Japan. The Pan-Asianists called for pre-colonial cultural revivals among their respective peoples, and also rejected the European state model of social organization in favor of a world brotherhood of nations animated by spiritual values. And I'm paraphrasing a statement from the Pan-Asianist propaganda of the period. So to realize this, the Tagores combined resistance to westernizing trends in the Indian independence movement with calls for the revival of India's traditional arts and culture. Kumaraswamy's contribution to this effort was to develop a critique of industrial capitalism which would bridge east-west divisions. This is a photo of Kumaraswamy taken in Sri Lanka in 1907. Kumaraswamy argued that India's Swadeshi, its independence, depended on the renewal of indigenous arts and the spiritual idealism that had shaped the subcontinent's pre-industrial, pre-colonial social order. He underlined this point in the foreword to his first important art historical study, Medieval Sinhalese Art, published in 1908, where he described the conditions in the region of Sri Lanka prior to British occupation. So Kumaraswamy's discussion of pre-colonial Sri Lankan culture and arts. He wrote that working under a social corporate structure not unlike that of early medieval Europe, craftspeople had produced art that was regarded by nobility and peasants alike as an integral feature of the religious practices which were the foundation of pre-colonial society in Sri Lanka. Artist craftsmen were intent not on expressing the external forms of nature, but rather the idea behind sensuous experience, a concept central to Indian religiosity. Out of this effort had grown a body of traditional forms, molded imperceptibly by successive generations, inspired by the religious idealism animating the subcontinent as a whole. Under British rule, however, industrial capitalism was destroying both the religious ideal in Indian art and the modes of production that tied this art to India's economic life. British colonialism had disrupted the nobility's sponsorship of the artist-craftsman. Worse still, under the imperial capitalist economy, machine-made mass-produced goods were introduced to the East. In medieval Sinhalese art, Kumaraswamy lamented the grim finality, and that's his term, grim. The grim finality of this process which drove the village craftsmen from their looms and tools, thus divorcing art from labor. Each craft's demise entailed the death of another sphere of the community's means of culture. This is Kumaraswamy speaking here. As imported goods displaced the economy of the artisan. So a very penetrating socio-cultural analysis here. Imperialism also introduced cultural values that were equally destructive of the arts. Although Frederick Leighton, who painted this epic academic work, The Nymph of the Shore, from 1868, would disagree with me, and Kumaraswamy. Imperialism also introduced cultural values that were equally destructive of the arts. Art in modern Europe was disconnected from any meaningful social function, and its academies promoted notions of beauty derived from ancient Greece and Rome. The complete divorce between art and life, as Kumaraswamy put it, blinded the colonizers to Indian art's organic relationship to the spiritual and material life of the people who gave it birth. As a result, European art critics compared Indian art to the Western academic prototype, and this is a academic prototype for you, and found the former wanting. Seeing no worth in India's cultural heritage, the British taught academic classicism in colonial art academies and neglected Indian religions and languages in institutions of higher learning. This is a painting by Ravi Varma, who studied with Theodore Jensen, a British painter, and this is the end result of his study. Thus, the British colonializers compounded the damage wrought by the economic assault on the subcontinent's arts and crafts with a cultural program of uplift that Kumaraswamy bitterly denounced. In his 1907 essay, The Deeper Meaning of the Struggle, Kumaraswamy argued that industrial capitalism could only be overthrown through a struggle for independence that would also renew the economic, social, and religious conditions which had forged the subcontinent's pre-capitalist way of life. The essay, The Deeper Meaning of the Struggle, is a heated polemic against nationalists in the Indian independence movement who argued that indigenous industrial capitalism and the adoption of European social practices were paths to independence. Those who pursued the wrong Swadeshi, Kumaraswamy wrote, had no appreciation of the interrelation between craft production and social identity. They rejected their own culture and stood indifferently by while the craft industries and hereditary skills that were the key to true arts and crafts as the foundation for a better social order in Europe, where art would be made by the people and for the people as a happiness to the maker and the user. And I'm sure some of the people here are familiar with Morris's arts and crafts critique of capitalism in the West. While Morris was working to realize his vision in England, he also extended it to the non-European world, an aspect of Morris's criticism that's lesser known. In 1882, he penned a stinging attack on the introduction of industrial goods to India, claiming that by displacing the traditional crafts, British imperialism was impoverishing Indian aesthetics and having a detrimental effect on cultural and religious life. Morris protested, but it was Kumaraswamy and the Swadeshi movement in India itself that gave this protest unprecedented force. Their anti-colonialism placed the arts and crafts at the forefront of a total refusal of industrial capitalism and much else besides. Kumaraswamy's criticisms of British imperialism were known in England. They were enthusiastically supported by numerous arts and crafts radicals. I mentioned C.R. Ashby as one of them, but another is Arthur J. Penty. Arthur J. Penty was a well-known arts and crafts activist who promulgated an anarchist form of guild socialism in which federations of community-run arts and crafts guilds akin to Kropotkin's federated communes were envisaged as replacing the state and privately owned industry. Like Kumaraswamy, Penty lamented the spread of industrial capitalism to the colonies and also its hold on Europe, but he also held out the hope that the world could yet turn the tide. In 1914, Kumaraswamy coined a term, post-industrialism, to characterize his program. He used this term to attack the Eurocentric progressivism of European and non-European modernizers, who in his own time were dividing the world into advanced and backward societies, and fetishizing the Western industrial capitalist experience as the most advanced stage that humanity was in. To speak of post-industrialism was to assert that the arts and crafts alternative Kumaraswamy was presenting was in fact an imminent form of modernity, not only in competition with European industrial capitalism, but destined to supersede it, or so Kumaraswamy hoped. Summarizing the position of himself and Kumaraswamy, Penty wrote that post-industrialists in both the East and the West were guided by a renewed medievalism which was ideological. Medievalism designated the critical attitude of the post-industrialist who, in Penty's words, challenged the concept of progress with his indiscriminating industrial advance by exalting an age which, whatever its defects, at least provides something concrete and tangible around which our thinking may crystallize. Neither Penty nor Kumaraswamy sought a wholesale resuscitation of medieval institutions. For them, the medieval period encapsulated a model for social organization for the future, something that you could adapt and work from. The most important feature of medieval society was the integration of spiritual idealism with the day-to-day activities of the population, primarily through art. Indeed, Kumaraswamy bluntly stated that the permanent revolution which post-industrialism represented could only be realized by means of art. And this, by the way, is a photograph of guildsmen at C.R. Ashby's guild in the Cotswolds. While Kumaraswamy agitated for a post-industrial rebellion against colonialism in the East, he also promoted a parallel revolt in the West. This is the message he propagated in numerous books and articles, including his major publication of the World War I period, The Dance of Shiva. And you notice that The Dance of Shiva was published by the Sunwise Turn bookstore, where Kumaraswamy was giving talks and building a circle of anarchists and like-minded in New York. The anarchist foundations of Kumar Swami's social theory are codified in the Dance of Shiva's closing essay entitled Individuality, Autonomy, and Function. And this title refers to three Hindu principles related to achieving enlightenment: self-becoming, self-rule, and self-realization through appropriate action. So, in this essay, Kumara Swami was signaling that his anarchism arose in the first instance from his own cultural heritage. Kumara Swami opened his essay observing that the object of government is to make the governed behave. We're sitting armed in his own house, prepared to repel the intruder. I'm quoting Kumara Swami there. The flaw of majority rule anarchism was that everyone remained focused on their own self-aggrandizement. The resulting anarchy of chaos, as Kumara Swami put it, would lead to an unstable social equilibrium that could only be righted by some return to a form of governmental tyranny. An alternative approach to individual autonomy was self-fulfillment through, quote, renunciation, a repudiation of the will to govern. If this ethos was adopted, there was nothing to prevent the recognition of common interests or the cooperation needed to achieve a harmonious society. Alert to the fact that some readers might construe his alternative to the anarchy of chaos as a call for state socialism, Kumara Swami quickly added that cooperation is not government, a reiteration of the principal theme of Kropotkin's 1887 manifesto, Anarchist Communism. Drawing on Kropotkin, Kumara Swami argued that the ethos of a renunciation encouraged the growth of mutual aid and allowed each individual to fulfill his own function. He called this form of social organization a spontaneous anarchy of renunciation. Spontaneous anarchism eliminated the desire for individuals to rule over each other, thus creating a stable equilibrium that could bring an end to social strife and discord. Kumara Swami called spontaneous anarchism his ideal. In practice, he envisaged the anarchist ethos of renunciation guiding society's reorganization under an enlightened executive. That's how he termed it. Though still retaining the semblance of government, the society of unending love and unending liberty would be blessed by the greatest degree of freedom and justice practically possible. In Individuality, Autonomy, and Function, Kumara Swami referred to the consciousness of the renunciating anarchist as a, quote, will to power, which sought not to govern others but only itself. A second essay from the Dance of Shiva, entitled The Cosmopolitan View of Nietzsche, developed this theme on the will to power. Here, Kumara Swami brought Indian religiosity, anarchism, and the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche together in a bid to give the post-industrial struggle in the West an individualist and idealist foundation similar to the East, where spiritual renewal along the lines of an anarchy of renunciation was a central feature of the coming post-industrial order. Kumara Swami opened his essay characterizing Nietzsche's philosophy as, quote, the religion of modern Europe, the religion of idealistic individualism. Nietzsche's Superman, he wrote, realized the unity and interdependence of all life and the interpenetration of the spiritual and material. This is why Nietzsche was so hostile to Christianity, Kumara Swami reasoned. Christians cleaved the sacred off from the secular and divided the world into absolute polar opposites of good and evil. Nietzsche's Superman, whose virtue stands beyond good and evil, was the Western equivalent of the Indian Arhat, the adept, the Buddha, the enlightened, the Jinnah, the conqueror, the Bodhisattva, the incarnation of bestowed virtue, and above all, the Jinnah Mukta, freed in this life, whose actions are no longer good or bad, but proceed from his freed nature. The Superman strove for inner harmony by ceasing to distinguish between selfish and unselfish actions. His supreme and only duty was to be what he was. And elsewhere, Kumara Swami summed up Nietzsche's philosophy as a process in which the individual gradually moved towards the real, by submitting to, quote, the artist, the saint, the philosopher within. For that reality, Kumaraswamy concluded, art thou. Lawrence J. Rosen has defined Indian religiosity as an absolute form of monism in which subjective consciousness is the critical unifying component. If, as in Indian thought, the individual is consciously to unite with the one reality, then that reality, writes Rosen, must be a kind of consciousness. Drawing on Nietzsche, Kumaraswamy constructed an individualist bridge between an Eastern religious ethos and a Western theory of social liberation, namely anarchism, filtered through Nietzsche. The importance of what I'd characterize as Kumaraswamy's transnational anarchism, however, really comes to the fore when we compare it with Marxism. And throughout this talk, consider that Kumaraswamy is writing at the same time as there is this very large social democratic Marxist-based movement going on. Let's get down to it. I mean, what's Marxism all about? Marx argues that the prerequisite historical stage in humanity's development towards a liberated society is industrial capitalism. As Marx conceived it, his endorsement of emergent industrialism in the West rendered his revolutionary program modern and materialist by virtue of its imminence in world history. East German workers, 1964. Of course, the question arises as to whose modernity Marx is talking about. For industrial capitalism and the train of political and social institutions associated with it has been, first and foremost, a Western affair. Indeed, the smug tenacity of Marxists who continue to locate modernity's imminence in industrialism to the exclusion of every other socio-economic system is, for me, remarkable, given that it's brought us to nothing less than an environmental and social catastrophe of planetary proportions. By way of contrast, the anarchism of Kumaraswamy represents a compelling instance of porous intermingling in which a European critique of industrial capitalism founded on the arts and crafts was turned to anti-colonial ends in a campaign against Eurocentric cultural imperialism and its material corollary, industrial capitalism. As we've seen, Kumaraswamy's Nietzschean renunciating ethos, which would resolve social conflict in favor of the bestowing virtue of the superman, was inseparable from his post-industrial economic order. This was an eminently anarchist project in which industrialism flourished under an equitable social order that was internationalist and, in retrospect, ecological to the core.
That's it for this week's show. Our next show will be available on Sunday, May 14th. InfoShop News can be found on the internet at news.infoshop.org. We bring you a variety of independent and mainstream news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can reach us by sending an email to chuck@mutualaid.org. We'd like to thank Erica and William for helping produce this show. Special thanks this week go out to Professor Dana Ward for organizing the Anarchist Conference in Los Angeles, and more thanks to the folks who graciously hosted me during my stay. Thanks to the Drunken Immortals for the music at the top of the show, and Strike Anywhere for the music you're about to hear. We'll talk to you again in a few weeks.
When they broke down the door, put the guards in the face of your wife and child, and as they pin you to the floor, did you say, officer, I'm not resisting you? American justice, American dream.